Welcome to the Voodoo Power Podcast.
Welcome to Plates and Pancakes. We're sitting down today with Eric Cash. Coach Cash has been the head strength and conditioning coach at Dorman High School since 2013. In 2020, he was named the NHS SCA Coach of the Year. Previous to Dorman, he was the head strength coach at Presbyterian College, Eastern Illinois University, and Elon University, along with the GA at Clemson. Coach Cash is strength and conditioning coach certified through the Collegiate Strength and Conditioning Coaches Association and an active member of the National High School Strength Coaches Association, where he is the national president along with the South Carolina president. He has a doctorate in kinesiology from UNC Greensboro, and his research interests center on the development of young athletes. So welcome to the show, Coach.
Man, thanks for having me.
No problem. It's probably more appropriate to call you doctor, but I don't get a whole lot of doctors, so we'll just call you coach.
That'd be great.
So the one thing, I'd listened to a few podcasts and looked into some of your stuff. I have some of your training protocols here that I looked into, but coming from the college weight room back to the high school weight room, the changes you had to adjust to make it work.
Yeah. So this has been, almost 11 years now. I simplified things a lot. I tried not to make it too complicated. Coming in, my goal was to kind of prepare athletes for college weight rooms because I knew what I was getting as a college strength coach. Kids that had injuries, kids that had been exposed to way too much already, which makes it, harder to adapt. They weren't really great at anything. So I want to establish a base for my kids here. And that way, when they go on to the next level, they can just continue to adapt.
So in the college weight room, would you have rather had a kid that knew nothing as opposed to one that had bad training for 4 years?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I'd rather had a kid that I could teach from scratch on my own instead of having to hit the reset button and get them to unlearn bad habits.
And sometimes at the high school level, do guys try to do too much to get an athlete prepared when it really may not take that much?
I think that's personal preference. That's just my philosophy. There's a thousand ways to train kids. If the kids believe in it and you're successful, then it doesn't really matter. Joe Ken is a mentor of mine, and he said to me for a long time, the most important metric is wins and losses, which I tend to agree with, because, you can have the best strength and conditioning program, from design to exercise selection to, gadgets used, whatever. But if you're not successful on the field, then it's kind of hard to connect the two. So wins and losses do matter. But I think there's things in the weight room that we do that may not be enough for somebody else. Whereas I look at what other people do and I'm like, I don't think we need to do that. But I don't know if anybody's really right or wrong. And speaking in absolutes in strength and conditioning is hard to do because there's so much variation from talent level to coaching styles, weight room setups, all that ties in, So speaking absolutes and strength and conditioning, to me, it makes no sense because things work over and over and over again, no matter, the level. And, I'm sure I could take my program and go to another school. We might not be successful, or I could take my program and go to another school. We might be really successful. But our kids, they believe in what we do and we are pretty successful. So I think that it's hard to say that like one way is right and one way is wrong.
Realizing youth athletes are becoming very specialized and making corrections on your end. I've heard you talk about that a little bit before, but it seems like the more we go into the future, the more specialized they're becoming. How do you find a balance to help that athlete get through and be successful while injury free?
Well, for us, where we are, we don't have very many multi-sport athletes. Most of our kids are single sport athletes and they play that sport year round. You know, we have, especially ninth grade and JV level, middle school level, yeah, multi-sport athletes, you know, but as they grow older, they're going to end up choosing one sport. Most of our kids do. You know, we have, I think, like 3 or 4 football players who play basketball. Most of our softball girls are softball only. Most of our volleyball girls are volleyball only. Baseball kids, most of those kids are all baseball. So soccer. It's just kind of the way it is. Most of our kids here, they play one sport at the varsity level. And that's another reason why I try to keep my training simple, because they are doing sport-specific practice year-round. I don't want to make things complicated in the weight room. I want to help them establish a base and try to, you know, we're never going to be able to just prevent injuries right out. You know, can we help reduce the incidence of injury by sound training? I think so. But again, never going to prevent it. And just, you know, across the board, that's kind of how we approach it with, multi-sport athletes. We still really don't have a lot. So, we have to find ways to train around the year round sport. Does that make sense? So, like our volleyball girls, you know, they play in the fall, and as soon as, like, they won state championship this year, as soon as that was over, they go straight into club tryouts, like, the next week. Not a week off, nothing. So, and then I have them in class all spring. So I find ways to train around practices. I find ways to train around, you know, when they go travel and play matches, you know, in Indianapolis, Florida, wherever they're going. And I try to find a way to get them to be able to continue to train, but also understand that they are playing nonstop.
Yeah. And that's a role that you've taken on that some people may just ignore, but that stuff exists. And to help your athletes be better at school, you have to adapt to what they're doing outside of school as well.
Exactly. You know, they practice, like, you know, I'm using volleyball as an example, but like volleyball, they practice twice a week. And then a lot of times they leave on Fridays, you know, and then they'll travel and play Friday night, play all day Saturday. And then they're coming back on Sunday and they're back in the weight room with me on Monday. So I try to find a way to map my training to help them where they can continue to train, but I'm not overloading them too much when they're coming out of a match or a big weekend.
Working at the college level and then coming back to the high school level, then you kind of worked it in reverse. So now you're sending good athletes to the college level, taking the injuries that you saw at the college level and trying to prepare the athletes at the high school level not to encounter those. What kind of changes did you make when you got back into the high school setting?
A lot of what I was doing at the college level, like Block Zero, for example, you know, Block Zero was an introductory program. Joe Kenyon was kind of the creator of it. And I started it, implemented it in 2007 when I got the head job at PC, and been using it ever since. So it's kind of it was designed originally because kids were coming in at the college level, not being able to move or not understanding how to hinge the hips and not understand how to land, posture, all those things that Coach Ken was seeing. That's kind of where they him and his staff at Boise, Utah, Arizona, Arizona State came up with this. And so it really works well at the high school level. So that's kind of our starting point for all of our kids when it comes to how can we help them understand how the weight room can connect them to the sport. Because we really want to work on posture. We really want to work on hip hinge, being able to stay tight when you're going into, you know, change of direction or land, you know, landing in a jump, whatever it is. We cover all that in our Block Zero program, which goes on at our middle schools. Once I get our kids, most of them have already had a Block Zero program implemented, gone through a Block Zero program. That way I can start with, you know, like an external load on things. So, you know, we had, when I was at the college level, obviously with female athletes, we saw a ton of girls coming in with ACL injuries, shoulder injuries, football kids. We saw a ton of shoulder injuries. We'd sign kids at Elon, that kid already had like two surgeries on his shoulder. You know, remember our soccer coach signed a girl who had two ACL injuries or two ACL surgeries already. And so those are things that I wanted to try to limit as much as possible. And again, knowing that I'm never going to be able to completely eradicate or eliminate it, but if I can slow it down, you know, reduce the incidence of injury, then that's what I was trying to do.
Now, why did the high school setting become so attractive? Why did you want to leave the college arena?
Well, I'm pretty lucky. So where I am at Norman is about 10 minutes from where I grew up. So that was a big draw coming back home. My brother was coaching here. The guy who coached me in high school, my position coach, was coaching here. So they called me when the job opened, and I knew I was going to get to design the weight room that we built. And at that time, you know, obviously there's a lot of great rooms, but at that time it was kind of the standard. You know, I mean, it's still great, you know, but a lot of rooms, you know, kind of got caught up with, which is fine. But I got to design the room the way I wanted it. It was better than any room that I had in college. You know, at the time we built it, you know, Clemson was still in the West end zone and Carolina was still in their facility at their end zone, and they were moving out. And, you know, we were probably one of the nicest in the state, even compared to those guys. But, you know, in this area is in general, because I grew up here, I coached here a little bit before I went to PC. I knew that it was not so much leaving college and going to a high school. It was leaving college and going to high school level athletics, but the expectations was like college. I mean, you know, football is very big here in this area. Basketball is huge. I mean, our basketball program is super successful. Volleyball program is unbelievable. I mean, some of the head coaches I work with, I mean, they're legends, you know, so it was kind of an easy transition. The expectations are really high, and it was just a, you know, come home, still get to coach at a high level.
I've traveled a little bit over my life, and I think there's a lot to be said for coming home, especially when you can come home and then you work in a facility like you have now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, parents live here. My wife's parents are, you know, when I was in Illinois, I was 9.5 hours, 10 hours away from my parents and my brother. We were 13 hours away from my wife's parents. So, you know, coming home gets us closer to everybody. So, and, you know, hey, I chased enough, man. Like, we had our daughter when I first went to PC. And that was a job where I was driving, you know, 74 miles round trip. And it was all interstate, easy drive, but it's still a long way, you know. And you got to start at 6 o'clock in the morning. You're leaving at 4:30. And you got groups all the way till 6 or 7. So you're not getting home. And you're talking, you know, 18-hour days. And I was here in Spartanburg driving to Clinton. But, it was still just crazy. So took the job at EIU. Moved us further away from home, but I was able to spend more time at home with my wife and my kid. Then transitioned to Elon, and we wanted to go through the adoption process. And it's not something that we felt like we could do if I was just continually to chase jobs. So that played a big part in it too. So coming home, and we ended up adopting our son 9 years ago, 9.5 years ago now. So yeah, family's a big part of why I got out of it.
Now, moving into the weight room a little bit more, I was kind of looking over your system, and I could have it off a little, just kind of what I found on the internet, but your system is kind of really essentially a 3-block system. You have 4 blocks in there, but it's kind of like an elite athlete would reach that 4th block. I didn't see where you used, you know, a lot of VBT to speak of or accommodating resistance. You kind of work off different rep maxes and set it up as you work through the blocks. Right. Is that kind of correct?
That's right. So the way I design my program is the tier system. And again, that's, you know, I've mentioned Joe Ken a couple of times already, but it, you know, tier system, he wrote the book on it. It's his baby. He created it. And again, I started learning it back in 2005 and 6 range. And then when I went to PC in 2007, first thing I did was schedule a trip to Arizona State and spent, I think 3 or 4 days out there with, House and his staff, and kind of just immersed myself into the tier system. And I've been using it ever since. You know, it took a lot of what I learned, programmer wise from Coach Batson at Clemson, and kind of, you know, use the organization of the tier system and how it's set up, and kind of put everything together and what I wanted, how I want to train, or how I want to train my kids. So, you know, we have a block 0 program, then what I would consider block 1 and block 2. Very rarely, you know, and this is going back to the original premise of block 0 and a long-term athletic development plan, quadrennial plan, that, you know, you go from block 1 to block 4. And when I was in college, you know, we would get into that block 3, what I would consider block 3, block 4. When I came to the high school level, especially where I was coming here at Dorman, those kids weren't ready for that. So I just decided not to do it. So no, we have not done VBT. We have not done accommodating resistance. That's just been my philosophy on it. You know, at Elon, at EIU and PC, we use Tendos. And if, you know, I have talked about, you know, with my staff about getting some VBT devices, but if I do go that route, it'll be more to drive intent. I'm a percentage guy. That's just the way I learned. That's the way that I've been doing it for so long. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing a 1 rep max. It's all about how you build it into your program and it's really about what your sport coaches want. If your football coach wants to do 1 rep maxes, then we're going to do 1 rep maxes. That's just, you know, that's the way it is. And it's all about how you build it into your program, because with the tier system, I can work at a heavy percentage in tier 1, and then I can turn around and go VBT in tier 2. So you can do both, you know, and then I can turn and hit volume in tier 3. All right. You know, I can do everything I need to do to train a kid for demands of sport within its confines of the tier system. So then that's where I go back to, like, don't speak in absolutes, because you don't have to be just all VBT. That may be your philosophy, and that's fine. You don't have to be all, you know, powerlifting and you know, train at a heavy percentage all the time and pursue 1 RMs. But if that works for you, then that's good for you. You know, so we do use a 1 RM for bench squat and power clean. But we don't train at that. We don't train at that percentage, at a heavy percentage all the time. You know, we go through like a linear progression. We'll use undulating. We use a ton of prilipin. So there's many different ways to train a kid, and that's one reason why I love the tier system.
Well, you just hit on it there, and that was going to be a question I had. I noticed on your paperwork, you do get into the prilipin system, where, you know, you could take your percentages and get your ideal reps,
right,
and set it up. And so even if you are working at a higher, a lighter weight, you can still be optimal. And I know,
I know
Louis built a lot of stuff on that too. So that's kind of how we've adjusted some stuff here. I seen, you know, where you kind of work into a 5-3-1, and that's essentially what we did with the 5-3-1. Windler had a 5x5-3-1. So you're, let's say you're at the 5 week, you're 65s for five reps, you're 75s for five reps, and you're 85s for five reps. Well, if you take that 85% by three and you do three sets of that, that puts you right in Perlepin's chart every time, no matter what. So I saw that in your paperwork and I figured that was a good spot to jump off and talk about that. Using that, how easy does that make your programming as far as volume?
So it just kind of depends on, like, right now, you know, I'll use football as an example. You know, right now where we are in our football program, we're training, we're getting more training time than we have in the past. You know, this time last year and 2 years ago, our training time we had a coaching change and our training time was just cut down tremendously. So we just weren't able to do as much. You know, like I told House a couple weeks ago, I said, man, I'm back to, you know, old school, you know, like we're doing, you know, like we did a heavy singles this week on power clean and we did three warm-up sets and hit five singles at 95%, you know? So, then we went into eight sets of three on box squat, you know, and then we went into, we use, the Elite FTS, a shoulder saver and we do a fat pad bench press, you know, with a drop set, you know, so it's just kind of some things that I haven't done in a while because we haven't had time to, but I've thrown 5-3-1 in on tier three because you do get that volume set at the end, you know, so, it depends on where we are and, how much time we have, you know. I, you know, just my personality, I like to be more in the off season on the high end. In season, I try to be more optimal to the low as far as our volume. One, our training time's down. Two, the sport, they got to worry about the sport more than they do than the weight room. So, but in the off season, I really like to be as high as I can on Prilipin's chart as far as volume.
Now, getting back into a system where you have time, that's what everybody's fighting. So to have the benefit of having some time with some football players, I'd imagine you're getting to do some stuff, like you said, that normally you would never get to do. But now you get to branch out. So how much fun is that, that you kind of get a break from the norm?
Oh, that's good, man. And, you know, and that's another reason why, like, I have mentioned to my staff, like, okay, maybe we need to start looking at doing some other things, you know, because when you have time, you know, it's great, but then you also have to have variety, you know? So we are training longer, but now I need to start throwing some different things in that way. It's not getting stale. Like we haven't box squatted in a couple of years. You probably actually correct. We haven't box squatted since pre-COVID because during COVID we couldn't, you know, COVID regulations, then coming out of COVID, my time got cut short and then we had a coaching change and time was really short. So I just didn't have the time to teach it the way I wanted to teach it. You know, we don't use accommodating resistance on it right now. I'm just, you know, going back and just teaching them how to sit to a box and, you know, that's been fun, you know, like getting them back to a box squat because, you know, to me a box squat is, you know, coming to a dead stop the way we teach it and coming out and then firing out of the hole, you know, translate to sport. But it also, like, I use it as a teaching tool for my kids who really struggle with technique, you know, so we use milk crates and we'll stack 45 pound plates up, you know, for a kid who used to, you know, just sitting, then falls, you know, okay, we need to add a plate and then we can get them perfect. And then we'll drop a plate and then we can drop a plate, you know? So, things like that, I have not been able to do in the last 3 or 4 years because I just haven't had time to do it. So that's been really cool. You know, I like the power clean and I like variations of a power clean. We don't get in snatches and things like that, but with more time, we do a lot more technique work now for our power clean, and our power clean technique has, you know, cleaned up tremendously. So yeah, it's been good, man. I mean, I've been able to do more, throw more things at them. Kids are buying into it, liking, loving it. So it's been good.
let's go back to the box squat there a second. And you were talking about how you stack up and you kind of meet the kid where their strength is and then start bringing them down. Along with that strength building, have you seen an increased mobility in the hips? Because you're getting a forced kind of resistance into that squat where, you know, they'll avoid that on a free squat where now everything has to start moving. And then maybe you see that better in your deacceleration or better in your sprints because they're more mobile.
Yeah, I think so. Now, you know, we don't teach a squat. And again, I got this from House, you know, almost 20 years ago. But like when we teach a box squat, we use the coaching cue sit on a glass table. So like we teach kids to sit tight, stay tight, not relax their hips or anything on the box. We want them to sit tight on the box, stay tight in a hole, and then just like they're coming out of a stance, you know, what it like it's a dead stop. We hold it for a two or three count and then we drive up as fast as we can. That carries over especially if you're for a kid who can't get there, then you know, we stack the plates up and, you know, say if a kid is on a four plate box, you know, over an 8 week period, I might get him down to a two plate, you know, so with that comes that extra range, that increased range of motion and flexibility for sure.
And I think what you got into there, staying tight, you know, kids will let that go on the bottom and they'll shed the forces they need to be absorbing. So then now when they sprint, they're not going to be able to absorb the forces as well. If you can get a kid to stay tight in that box squat the whole way through, I think you're going to have a more explosive athlete just because they've learned to adapt to the forces that are on them.
Right. That's right. 100%. You know, because most of the time, you know, we talk about like a landing, you know, when you land from a jump, you know, we want to be tight as we can be. You know, I tell them everything needs to be tight from the toes all the way to their head. And it's the same thing when we squat. We teach our front planks, you know, that's, you know, we talk about, think about, so walking, somebody walking by you, kick you in the stomach, you're bracing for impact. Everything's about staying tight and bracing for impact. And so that's why, like, I don't want my kids relaxing their hips on the box. I want them to be tight as they can, stay tight as possible, sit on that glass table. And then after that dead stop, they fire out of the hole as fast as they can.
Yeah, that was just something that I had stumbled on a while back. And so to talk to coaches that kind of see it that way helps corroborate what I thought I was seeing. You can see a kid really drop them hips in there. And then,
right,
you know, they're losing those forces. Well, at top speed, you're wanting that kid to be able to have the strength to keep his hips held up. So I think maybe that's some of why the box squat can create a faster athlete is because the hips are so much stronger when they keep them tight.
Right. And, you know, again, it goes back to, that's just the way we teach it, you know, and that's the way that I think it translates to sport, and doesn't mean that, you know, we're right within our program, but doesn't mean that other people are wrong, you know? So I know that people train in different ways and have different philosophies about it. That's the way we look at it. So, and we think it helps us. In the last 6 weeks we've been training, you know, We think we can tell a difference. You know, the kids think they can tell a difference. And that's the most important thing. You know, if the kids are confident in what they're doing, then that's the transferable trait that you're looking for. You know, confidence is the number one trait you're looking for. And if you get it by doing VBT, great. If you don't, great. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Taking that a little further, I've heard you talk about it before, maybe even on a podcast with Joe Ken, but through all the arguing on social media, there is no secret sauce. And, you know, what you do with your athletes, somebody else is going to do something totally different. And they both are effective.
That 100%. I mean, now, do you want to be sound? Yes. You know, like you want to be sound in your technique. But if I teach a box squat one way compared to somebody across the road who teaches a different way, but we're both successful programs, then are they not both working? You know? So the speaking in absolutes on social media, I think it's bad for our field, because there are people that have been doing this a long time and have had a lot of success. And just because they don't necessarily want to change to something that's new doesn't mean that they're, you know, wrong. I think that you have, you got to start, and it's something I have to start doing. You know, in today's landscape of athletics, kids move, parents are way more involved, private trainers are way more involved. And, you know, there are some things that, you know, I think coaches may need, and myself included, might need to sacrifice on a little bit to keep the kids and the parents. Oh, yeah, they're doing this. Even though it's just kind of just sprinkling it in a little bit, I'm not really sacrificing on what I really believe. But, you know, there is no secret sauce. Now, you could have the wrong sauce if you're not doing sound programming. If your technique is not sound with your kids, you know, then yeah, you got to fix that. But as far as the intricacies of a program, you know, you got sound technique, sound exercise selection, then, you know, we just need to leave coaches alone to be supportive. Just because they do it one way doesn't mean that they're wrong.
Now, I did have a question. I was looking through some of your blocks, and take this one for example. You had 6 reps at a 50% 3 rep max, and 10 reps as you're working through 10 reps at 50% 6 rep max. And then kind of you finished at the end with the 12 reps. Sorry. 12 reps at a 50% 10 rep max. Do you figure all those rep maxes, or do you come off of one rep max and progress it out?
Can you tell me what you're looking at?
This is talking about trying to see what program this is of yours. I want to say maybe, well, crap, I got them out of order here when I was looking at them. Okay. It was, well, heck, I got a camera. I wanted to show you.
Okay. Yeah. So APRE.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's just, you know, that's like, yeah, everything's based off of a one rep max.
Okay.
And most of the time when I'm doing APRE, it's coming back from Christmas break. So we're going, so I'll use it for a couple of weeks. And so, you know, the last max they actually have is from the summer, especially with our football kids. But this is really about football. So, you know, we train up to 95% in season, and especially if we're going deep in the playoffs, you know, we'll hit a 95% single. So now we don't ever go to, you know, to a PR, but when we go to, when we get done with the season, depending on if it's mid-November, you know, December, whatever, wherever we are in the playoffs, you know, we either give them off time, then we hit Christmas break, or, you know, like this year we weren't very good. So, we trained for 6 weeks, you know, so I didn't need to do APRE coming back. But a lot of times, you know, we'll make it to Thanksgiving weekend or state championship game. Then, you know, we'll give them off a week. Then I really don't have a lot of training time. So we'll open over Christmas break, get as many as we can in here, do some, you know, some transitional type stuff, you know, to kind of bridge the gap between the end of the season and the off season. And then we'll come back in January, and I'll hit some of that APRE for a couple weeks. And because we're going off of their old maxes, it's already at a reduced load. So it's not like we've tested them, you know, at the end of the season. You know, we don't do that. We don't test at the end of the season to get a, you know, a new max. Like, to me, that would not be sound programming, in my opinion. So we'll just use what we have. We don't have to adjust it to get to a lighter, you know, training max. We'll just train on because if you hit 95% for singles at the end of the season through a 14, 15 week cycle, odds are you're stronger already. But if you train at a lower max or lower percentage training max when you come back in January, then I'm not asking to train at a higher load. So we'll hit that for a couple weeks, and then we transition into like a true linear periodization. And then another thing about for us programming in January is that we have regional strength meets and a state strength meet. So this next Saturday, we have our regional strength meet. We'll have there's 12 regions in the state. I host our region. We'll have 5 or 6 schools here that'll train. We'll test bench squat and broad jump And then the state meet is at the end of March. So we kind of figure that into our programming as well.
Okay. So at your strength competitions, you're leaving out the deadlift and you've substituted it with the broad jump?
Yeah. So our strength association has been around, I want to say, since like 89. And it was originally created to create competition for football players in the off season. And so originally it was bench, squat, vertical jump, and a 40. And then it transitioned to bench, squat, broad jump, and a 40, probably back in the early 2000s. And then recently we just dropped the 40, and now we just do bench, squat, broad jump.
So let me ask this. What kind of broad jump lengths are you going to be seeing on some of them top athletes out there?
Oh, man. We'll have skill kids that'll jump over 10 feet. I've got a couple that are close to touching 10, but like, I mean, some of the athletes in the lower part of the state, I mean, they'll be 10.5, 10.6s, you know, broad jumps. So, and that's the reason why we kept it in is because we wanted to have an athletic component to the meet. Some people would love to see us add the power clean. Problem with that is that not everybody in our state has bumpers. They can't train a power clean, you know. So then, okay, well, what about the deadlift? Well, you know, maybe not everybody coaches it the way it's supposed to be coached. And then you open kids up to injuries, you know. So that's just one thing we didn't want to add, and we wanted to keep an athletic component to it, so we kept the broad jump.
All right, so we're, you know, you could take a pretty young athlete, and when you start hitting them about 8 foot, that's a lot for them, and that's looking pretty good. So then you start getting up to that 10.5. That's exceptional.
Oh, yeah.
Creating that big broad jump, what do you look at to help athletes with that?
Well, we do a ton of jumping. we'll train a ton of jumps. You know, the big thing about a broad jump is that kids got to learn how to get their hips extended. You know, I talk about like doing a belly flop in a pool. You know, you want to lay out as long as you can, and that way you get your hips through, and then at the last second, shoot your feet forward and stick your landing. And I've taken pictures from the combine and put them up on the screens and the TV, TV in the weight room. We talk about, you know, hey, listen, when you're doing a broad jump, this is where you're supposed to be, you know, and then we kind of connect the broad jump to acceleration. You know, you take the acceleration phase, and like, you know, we'll take a start and I'll take a screenshot of it, and then we'll put it up on the screen and we'll put a broad jump up and then compare the two. Because there are correlations between each other. They parallel each other. So we do a ton of jumping to help with that. We talk about it. We do a ton of kettlebell swings. You know, we talk about pressing our hips, you know, extending our hips when we swing. So we try to do exercises to help with the concept of pushing the hips through, getting extended.
Now, we've talked about it going through here, not shying away from the one rep max anymore. I talk to a lot of coaches. Some coaches are dead set against it. Some coaches love it. And you fall on the end that you want to get your kids heavy. Why do you prefer that heavy component in there?
I think it just goes back to personal preference. And, you know, a lot of it comes from the sport coach as well. Like our basketball coach, he wants to know what their one rep maxes are. Our baseball coach, he wants to know what their one rep maxes are. I kind of lean on those coaches a little bit. You know, I'll talk to them and, you know, we can talk through things, but I guess their program, you know, and if I can safely implement a 1RM, which I think we can, then I don't see a problem in it. I don't see a harm in it. You know, we don't have kids who get hurt doing 1RMs. You know, if a kid, our big thing is we want a 5 pound PR. You know, 5 pound PR first, then it's up to the coach's discretion on how we add, you know. So, and I think we do a good job of not chasing a ton of numbers. you know, we'll shut a kid down. We don't ever want a kid to fail. We want it. We want them to have something left in the tank, you know, so they get that 5 pound PR and it, you know, and they, we don't think they can go up, then they're done. We shut them down. You know, we're not going to go load the bar and try to get another 5-10 pounds and risk a kid getting hurt. But I think there's excitement for the kids because most kids, you know, they want to do one RM. I think that, there's also a mental aspect to it, you know, preparing yourself for doing something that's hard. I think there's a focus aspect to it. And, you know, it kind of carries over in our eyes, the way we approach it with our program.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that any meathead athlete you have is going to know his one rep, whether he does it with you or he does it at his buddy's house. They are going to do it. They know what their squat is. They know what their deadlift is, and they know what their bench is.
That's right. So that was something, I guess, something else I could follow up on. Like, you know, we have kids that I know train outside of here, you know, whether it's on they're on their own or they're with a private trainer. You know, so they'll ask, what can I do? Cause I said, well, we're doing this today. You need to do this, you know. Don't go squat heavy on Wednesday night because we're going to turn around. We're going to squat heavy on Thursday. You know, Thursday's a big squat day for us, the way we map our program. So, like, don't go squat on Wednesday. You know, don't load the bar on Thursday night for bench because we're going to bench on Friday. You know, so, like, yes, they are going to do it. You know, and that's something that, you know, like, I think is another reason why I want to start sprinkling in some other things, because if I'm not doing it with them, then they're going somewhere else to do it. And I would rather them do it with me, because I feel like that I have a better handle on things and I can coach it better. Our staff can coach it better. So, you know, if you're not timing a 40, I promise you, they're going to get time somewhere else. You know, if you're not doing a one rep max, they're going to figure out what their one rep max is, especially on a bench press, you know, and the true meathead kid is he wants to squat too. Now, they may not go power clean, but they probably go deadlift. You know, so yeah, I'd rather it be with me and then give them other things to do besides that if they're going to go train on their own.
The other component I started thinking about as I was talking to some guys, and it never really dawned on me, but the game is max effort. You know, you're pushing it to the ends of your ability if you're playing your hardest in a game. So, you know, being able to do that in the weight room, the one rep max is about the only thing that probably can match that in mental capacity. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, people that, you know, don't want to do a one RM, you know, I think sometimes their argument is that I don't have to do a one RM. I can do VBT to get that number. You know, I don't have to have a one RM, which is, that's fine. That's you. That you do what you want to do. And I'm not saying you're wrong. But just because I do a 1RM, you know, doesn't mean that I'm wrong either. Because we don't just do, I think the assumption is a lot of times is that coaches who do one rep maxes is that they don't do anything else. You know, and that's where I go back to programming. You know, so within the tier system, I can hit a 1RM, but I can also, if I want to do dynamic effort, I can do dynamic effort. If I want to do a repeated effort method, I can do a repeated effort method. You know, I can hit all that in the same day, you know, so there are no absolutes. There's nothing that, you know, says that this way is best and this way is not. And I think the sooner people can start go back to respecting what other people do, you know, I mean, you know, we had a Zoom the other night with the NHSSCA, and, you know, me and Hal talk about it all the time, but he brought it up. He's like, you know, Gittleson in Michigan went to like 30 something bowl games straight. And he's a hit guy, you know? So does that mean he's wrong? I mean, so the record on the field says that they were pretty daggum successful, you know? So, I don't have an answer except for that. I think that it's not, there are no absolutes. And the sooner people realize that, then I think we're better off.
The willingness to adapt has a great carryover. You know, you might change your opinion in 5 years on what you thought was wrong when you were younger. It's amazing how maturity and different athletes change your outlook on how you do things.
Right. That's right. You know, maybe if I'm somewhere else or we're not as gifted athletically, maybe I need to try to do a little more. You know, I don't know, because I'm not in that situation. You know, we have athletes here in most of our sports. So I try to keep things simple, because like I said earlier, I know they're doing a ton of sport specific work. You know, a lot like the kids who are really, really successful in baseball, they have hitting coaches outside of baseball, most likely, you know, or softball the same way. Volleyball, you know, they're practicing year round, you know, whether it's practice on Tuesday, Thursday, then they might have individual lessons throughout the week, and then they're playing tournaments on the weekend. So I think that, you know, it's all about your situation and what your student population is. I'm not going to throw shade on anybody because they're doing things a certain way. If people want to throw shade, you know, other ways, that's fine. But, you know, like I said, we do what we do, and our kids believe in it. Our coaches believe in it, and we're pretty successful.
We've talked about Joe Kinn quite a bit, but I've heard you talk about Coach Batson and his influence on you. What did you take from him that you incorporate quite a bit of now?
Oh, man. Coach B, you know, is great for me. You know, the Clemson coaching tree at one time was probably one of the best in the country. You know, I think he had like 9 head coaches, his strength coaches, when I was still a his strength coach. And, you know, Coach B, because I still talk to him, you know, a ton. I was really lucky. I got to coach his kid. He transferred his kid here his senior year. And, you know, I got to coach Ben, who was, you know, watching Ben as a kid and then moving away, and then him moving Ben here and getting to coach him for a year. Man, it was very surreal for me. It was just, you know, an honor to get to coach Coach Batson's son. You know, Ben's married or getting ready to get married, so got a wedding to go to here soon. And, you know, Coach B's been a huge help for me as a mentor, from how to deal with coaches. You know, and that's something that as a strength coach, I think, you know, sometimes strength coaches might forget. Like, we are support staff. You know, as much as we want to beat our chest and talk about how great we are, you know, at the end of the day, it's about wins and losses. And if your basketball coach is not successful, then you got to find a way to help him be successful. You know, so we are support staff. And that's something that, you know, I talked with Coach Batson about a lot, was, you know, especially early on, you know, how do I deal with this head coach who wants to do this, this, and this, but, you know, it's not sound or it doesn't make sense. And, you know, so I think dealing with coaches, building relationships with coaches was a big piece of what I learned from Coach B. You know, and then from a program design standpoint, like, you know, I still use, you know, a lot of, you know, everything used to be done in like big spiral notebooks like this, you know, and this thing sits on my desk. You know, I've had it on my desk since 2007. So, because I've been a head strength coach for 16 years, almost 17 years now. And, you know, that's been on my desk ever since, because it's something that I kind of go to, you know, but everything used to be spiral bound. You know, so I have like all of our old, over on my bookshelf, I have all of our old power programs, what Coach B called power programs, bench, squat, deadlift. And, you know, I will use that that map. Like, say, if we're doing squat, you know, okay, I'll go to the power program and I know that on week one that I'm going to hit rep scheme, and this is what my percentages are, you know. So, and that's where, like, I've taken a little bit of learning under Coach B and then kind of meshed it in with what I've learned for House and kind of melded the two together. So, but yeah, I mean, Coach B, I can't say enough about him as far as like what he's meant to me professionally, you know, as a friend, as a mentor, and, you know, I learned a lot. So,
now, you mentioned it multiple times in the podcast so far, but establishing buy-in from your players, and that's where you're going to see the greatest results in whatever it is you're doing. So what do you implement to help create the buy-in? Does it just come from results, or is there another component we're missing?
No, I think that at the end of the day, kids want structure. And kids, like, if you hold them accountable, and that's something for us football-wise, this we started after we lost in the first round of playoffs last year. And, you know, I'm very lucky. Our head coach that we hired last year was my assistant head strength coach. Like, he worked under me for 9 years. He started out as middle school head coach, but he was working in a weight room with me. Then he kept moving up the ladder in football, but he was still under me for 9 years. So, like, he understands, and we would talk about, like, man, if we could just do this, you know, for the last 9 years. And then, like, once he got the opportunity to put his stamp on the program at the end of the season last year, like, the buy-in's been unbelievable. And a lot of it is that we're just making them do by, you know, holding them accountable and putting in time and work. The kids are just buying in, you know, and with the time and the work, they see transformation happen. And then the confidence comes in, you know, so, like, they're seeing everything change and their confidence is increasing. So, again, like, confidence is the number one transferable trait from the weight room to the field. So if they're more confident because we are spending more time in the weight room and because we're holding them accountable, then that is how we've created the culture change for us. It's been unbelievable for the last 2.5 months.
Now, going the totally opposite way of that, with everything in life that gets thrown at you and long hours, keeping everyone, including yourself, mentally motivated to keep everything at a high level. I know burnout happens. How do you kind of prevent getting drugged down?
Well, it was something that when I came to the high school level, that was something that was part of the reason why we wanted to do it. But it was also there was a focus on family because, you know, we had a really bad car wreck in 2009 that kind of changed our lives forever. And coming home, we were able to kind of recenter everything. And, like, I never had a hobby, you know? And to me, that's something that I missed out on a ton of, because I would go to work, come home late, go to bed, wake up, repeat, you know, over and over and over again. And so I never had a hobby, you know? And, like, now, man, I do woodworking all the time. You know, I'll build kitchen tables, desk, you know, whatever it is. You know, somebody asks me to build it, I'll get it built. And I go fly fishing a lot. I got into hunting when I came back, you know. So I think, you know, from a personal standpoint, it was really big for me just to establish something outside of the weight room, you know. From a family standpoint, it was really big to be able just to spend time with my family, you know, so, because now I can do it all, you know. If I have a group in the morning, you know, I'm usually here by 7, we're training in the morning. But I still get to get my kids up, make sure they got breakfast, you know, whatever, say bye to them. Then I come to work. If I don't have a group, then, you know, it's take my son to school. You know, daughter's getting ready to graduate in a year. I don't have to worry about her anymore. But, you know, I could take her to school instead of, you know, when I was at Elon, I'd go to work at 6. And then I would leave as soon as the group was over to go meet her at the school, walk her into the building, and then trying to go back to work for another group, you know. So it wasn't really any quality time to spend with her. That's completely flipped now. You know, like I get to be in my kids' lives more. I get to go to Little League basketball games, Little League basketball practice, soccer, flag football, whatever it is. You know, my daughter does CrossFit, so I get to go, you know, watch her. If I want to watch her compete on a Saturday morning, I don't have to worry about recruiting visits, you know, things like that. So, I think you have to find a way to have that emotional and mental release away from the job. Because if you don't, like, there will be burnout. Like, at some point, you're going to get fed up. And that's why I think you see a lot of coaches from the college level coming to the high school level, you know, or they'll go to the military side of things, the tactical side, or they'll go into the equipment sales, you know, just so they can stay plugged in to the strength side of things. But like, there's definitely a burnout that can happen, and you got to find a balance so that you can prevent that.
So how is the fly fishing out there? I don't know much about South Carolina fly fishing. Is it good there?
It's pretty good, man. You know, we've got the Smoky Mountains and the Blue Ridge Mountains. So, you know, you can hit, I'm actually going here at the beginning of April on a float trip to Johnson City. You can float the Watauga or the South Holston River for big browns and rainbows. So those are probably the two biggest streams on this side of the country that kind of resemble like a western stream in Montana or Idaho or Wyoming. So but you know, like me and my brother and a couple of our buddies, we go out west every year, you know. So we've been to Montana the last 4 years. Now we're going to Colorado this summer for a few days to fly fish, and I love it, you know.
My daughter used to play in the Sparkler softball, and that's 4th of July weekend in the Denver area. So yeah. You get a day off out there between it, and me and her went to Deckers, Colorado, and fly fished. And man, that was just unbelievable. A lot of browns. It was a good time.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Fly fishing is something. It's kind of like, if you're fly fishing where there's heavy pressure, it's almost like hunting. Like, you got to stalk them. You can't be seen, because if they see your shadow, you're not going to catch it. You know, if your tippet's too thick, or if you're, you know, leaders, you know, not long enough, man, you got no shot. You know, you got to have the right fly on. It got to be the right size. And if you catch one, like, you know, it was like stalking a deer, you know, you spent time doing it. So, and then you're out there like in the mountains, and, you know, just can't beat it. You know, like last year we were in Yellowstone fly fishing, and we're fishing Lamar River, and, man, there's buffalo all around us. And, you know, you got to keep your head on a swivel because you got high grass, and you'll hear something snort, and you're like, oh man, golly, that buffalo comes up behind me. I don't know what I'm going to do. So, but yeah, it's good times.
We went up into Rocky Mountain National Park, and I want to say that's the headwaters of the Arkansas up there. I think so. And caught some brooks up there.
Yeah. The Big Thompson headwaters in Rocky Mountain National Park too. You catch cutthroat on the Big Thompson right outside of Estes Park. So
in Montana, you go up to Madison.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, man, we're off strength training right now. That's awesome. So, So last year we spent 2 days on the Madison. We did one on the Yellowstone, and then 2 days on the Lamar River in the park. So, and then the year before that, we actually did on the Missouri, up outside of Craig, Montana, outside of Helena. You can just rent a boat yourself and do your own float trip. That was very hard. It wasn't, you know, trying, because we were both, me and my brother were in one boat, and our buddies were in another boat, and we're both trying to take turns fishing. And again, it goes back to, you got to know exactly what fly, you know, to match, to hatch. And if you don't, you got no shot.
I cowboyed up north of Great Falls outside of Glacier, and we've had to go back since then, because when we were cowboying, I didn't have time to go do all that stuff that I wanted to do. But once we got back home and we went back to a normal job, then we'd go out there and fish some. Yeah, we fished Yellowstone a little bit, and my daughters, they like to go. Here in Missouri, we don't have much. We have some. Oh, we have Bennett Springs and a few of those creeks that the conservation office maintains, but it's nice to get back out into the mountains where everything's a little quieter and a little calmer.
Right. Oh man. I guess it was about 5 years, 6 years ago. I told my wife it's something I want to do. So the first year I went, I actually went by myself. And I mean, fly fishing over here is much harder than it is out west, because here you have a lot of cover. You know, you come back and your fly gets stuck, you know, you're trying to, you know, slingshot it or, you know, little roll cast, whatever. And out west, everything's wide open. So most of the time you're just, you know, just rocking and rolling. So, but still, I didn't know a whole lot about it. You know, it was really hard. Now, my first few days, I didn't catch anything. And then I got on the Gardner in the park and had a great day, which you can't fish anymore because of the flood. You can't even get to the Gardner, to the fishbowl party anymore. So, but yeah, man, I love it. So it's something I look forward to a lot.
Well, before we get off the subject, one place I'd like to go is I'd like to go to the San Juans and use a mouse. You know, you see them catch them huge browns on a mouse in New Mexico. Oh, yeah. Oh man, that'd be amazing.
We caught, well, actually on the, I think it was Armstrong Spring Creek, 3 years ago, we, I didn't throw a mouse pattern. My buddy did. And he caught a brown trout on a mouse pattern. The most epic day I've ever had was on Armstrong's, and we struggled all day, and then storm comes up, and we have to sit in the car for like 2 hours because it's, I mean, this was back, they had hoot owls on the river, so you had to be off by 2. So a lot of people were hitting spring creeks because of the being done by 2. And you know, for people that don't know, hoot owls is because it's hot, water temperature rises, and then if you catch a fish, you can end up killing it. And they really try to do a good job of protecting the trout, the wild trout out of Montana. So, so we fished the Spring Creek that day, and it was about 6 o'clock, and the storm comes up, and you know, we're just sitting there. I'm like, you know what, man? Because he could see it over the mountain that it had passed. And I said, you know what? I'm going. I don't care. I don't care if it's thunder. I don't care if it's lightning. I don't care. And because you know, when the wind starts blowing, they start feeding on the edges for hoppers, you know, grasshoppers about that big, you know. So I put a big foam hopper on and I'm letting it float along. Man, I absolutely slayed them. It was unbelievable. So that's my best memory of fly fishing so far, man. It was awesome. I called it. I knew it was going to happen and I knew exactly where they were. And it was great.
I keep saying you know, doing this podcast, I've met so many coaches all over the country and then connected with other coaches on Instagram and stuff like that. And yeah. One summer, I'm just going to have to throw the fly rod and stuff in the car and then go meet some of these coaches and then do some fishing and then just kind of tie a vacation into meeting some of these guys.
Hey, listen, man, I go every year. So if you don't want to go with me, you just let me know.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate the offer.
You got an invitation. Like I said, we're going to Colorado this year. Because the snowpack is down so much in Montana, so we're just anticipating that they're going to be on hoot owls and they'll have heat or whatever, you know. So that's why we're going to Colorado. But if they get a ton of snow this coming December, January, February, then snowpack goes up, then we'll go back to Montana next year. So like I said, man, I'm going somewhere. You just let me know.
I appreciate the offer. We'll see how things shake out. So we'll kind of come back around to some coaching and strength stuff and we'll get you out of here and let you enjoy your day. But
yeah, no problem.
Managing success. You guys have had a lot of success there. So the expectation grows, but sometimes kids don't meet the expectation because they just expect it to happen. So managing right. The success of a program.
Well, I think what ends up happening is there's kind of a natural reset. You know, because when that happens, when kids, you know, start getting too big for their britches, you know, there's not this success on the court or on the field, you know, so there's kind of a natural reset in that. And then like, let's, you know, once that senior class leaves, you know, you're able to say, listen, you know, that's not the standard. We have to do things this way to get back to the way that it's supposed to be. You know, that's something for football this year. We've kind of had a natural reset because, you know, we went 3-8 and, you know, it's Coach Morris's first year, but he's a third head coach in 3 years. So there's a lot of things that happened for the third head coach in 3 years. You know, the guy that retired, you know, 3 years ago, you know, he was a legend. You know, he's in the Hall of Fame in North Carolina. He's in the Hall of Fame in South Carolina. He's one of the winningest coaches in South Carolina football history. And, you know, he was a legend. And, you know, when he retired, another guy comes in. He's only here for a year. You know, then they hired, you know, Coach Morris to be the head football coach. And, you know, he's got a different philosophy than everybody. You know, so you got to have to hit that reset button. It's hard to implement it when you get hired in February, March and get ready for the season coming up, you know. And then now, because of the 3-8 season, which we haven't had a losing season at Dorman in probably 40, 50 years. I don't know the last time there was one. You know, it's probably the late 80s or early 80s rather. So the natural reset is that we're 3-8. Do you want to be 3-8 again? You know, if you don't want to be 3-8 again, this is what we got to do. And so I think that, you know, it's hard to stay at the top all the time. There's a, you know, if you stay at the top for all, you know, you got to figure it out. You're able to, you know, win national championship after over and over and over and over and over again, that you're doing something different than everybody else is. You know, there's always going to be a drop off. You know, hopefully it's not as a drop off like we had, you know, but that's enabled us to, like I said, hit that reset button. And now we're rolling. You know, at the high school level, there's always going to be waves of talent, right? You know, I mean, especially in our area, you know, we don't have open enrollment where kids can just transfer, you know, with a drop of a hat. You know, like I've heard in Florida, you can play football at one school in the fall, and then you can transfer in spring and play baseball. You know, you can't do that in South Carolina. Now, we do have transfers. There are kids who transfer, but it's not wholesale change. And, you know, so there's always going to be, you can always see what's coming. You know, so like, if you know a drop's coming, it just didn't time up well for us this year because we were on our third head coach. We knew there was going to be a drop, so it just was kind of the perfect storm. But we know what we got coming, you know, for football. You know, we got talent coming, so we're hitting that reset button, and culture's changing, buy-in's happening, and hopefully we can translate it to wins on the field.
Now, you started getting into the next question I was going to ask, and I talked to John Kirshner in Indiana the other day, and Coach Kirshner kind of got on into the economics of coaching, and you touched on it there. Is at the top, you're looking out over the next 4 or 5 years, and you can see dips that are coming, like you kind of mentioned. Preparing and managing for those dips, is there anything in there that you can do to maybe make the dip not be so drastic?
I think a lot of it comes back to how your head coach supports you, because, you know, if things were the way they were now, I don't know if the dip would have been as bad, you know? So like the last 2.5-3 months, man, like, I mean, it's just been great. You know, Jake, you know, Coach Morris is crushing it. You know, he's holding the kids accountable. You know, he's putting his thumbprint on the program, and I think that by doing that, because what I tell coaches is that some of the best head coaches I've ever been or been around are high school coaches. You know, Bobby Bentley was at Burns in the late '90s or in early mid-2000s, and you know he changed the landscape for football in South Carolina. You know, Burns was the program for a long time, and they won 4 in a row, and then we lost in the playoffs 2006, and then he left and went to PC, and then I went with him to be a strength coach. But then in 2007, they reloaded, you know. But a lot of that is, you know, the accountability and the work that was going into the program, and that even if there was a gap in talent, the kids knew what the expectations were. And that's something that our head basketball coach here and our volleyball coach here, again, I talk about legends, you know, Paula Kirkland has won 16 state championships in volleyball. She's been here 30 something years. I mean, she's won like 1200 matches or something. She's phenomenal. And our head basketball coach has won 5 of the last 7 state championships, you know? So like those two coaches here, Coach Gutshaw before he retired, and Bobby Bentley, man, those are like legends when it comes to how to, you know, run a program. And so we've hit that reset button back to where we need to be. And I think as long as you can maintain that, but again, a lot of that comes because we are support staff. You know, it does no good for me to try to drop the hammer on a kid and hold them accountable in the weight room if when they go to practice or this, that, it's got to be the other way around. You know, like the standard set in the sport and by the sport coach, and then we support that, and then they support us, you know, because we're trying to help them get their wins on the court or on the field. So I think by having those standards in place, you know, and that goes back to communication and relationship with your sport coaches, like I think that's how you can kind of bridge the gap for those dips, you know. And because you know, let's say you have a 10th grade, 11th grade class that may have a dip, but odds are your senior class, your ninth grade class are pretty good. So you can kind of fill the gaps a little bit. But if you don't have that standard set, then you can't.
Okay, so I'll wrap up with this question and we'll see what you think of it. But your sport coach has goals. You as a strength coach have goals. And your athletes have goals. And sometimes the athletes' goals don't get focused on very much, and they're just as important as everybody else's goals. So helping your athletes realize the goals they have and actually knowing what the athletes' goals are, how important is that in the grand scheme of things?
I think it is important, but I also think it varies by sport. You know, just by nature, football tends to be more weight room oriented than most other sports. That's just the way it is, right? So it's just by nature. Now, if you have a sport coach who, you know, has that mentality, you know, I forget about Brady Sally. He's the head women's basketball coach at Ball State. He was our women's basketball coach at EIU. He was a weight room warrior, man. Like, he wanted his girls training, and they were great. You know, he supported it 100%. And I think it just, a lot of the times it depends on the sport coach. But for goals, like for football, like kids will say, like, you know, I want to get a 5, 10, 15 pound PR or, you know, whatever it is. I think with the sports where, you know, like we would do one rep maxes, but it may not be as important to, and that's something I've learned over my time here is like for basketball, a one rep max for basketball, for me, it's just to get a number so we can train. It's not near as important for a basketball player to have a true 1RM as it is for a football player, you know, in my mind. So the skill side of things for basketball is way more important than the weight room. And that's something me and our basketball coach talk about all the time. Like, we want them to work because they need to work. You know, they maybe it's a weight gain. They need to get bigger, need to, you know, to gain some weight. But that the byproduct of that is, okay, they've increased their 1RMs. It's not, we need to increase their 1RMs. The focus changes. Like, your messaging changes a little bit. So the goal for a basketball player is more about the skill development and how, you know, how they're playing defense or how they're hitting their shots. Then it's, okay, how can we do things in the weight room to help that? You know, so it might be a little different from one sport to the next. You know, the personal goals for a football player may be directly more directly related to the weight room because that's just the nature of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing that I might ask is there is a driving component in other sports in the weight room, but they may not realize it. Like your basketball player, the vertical jump is their prize. Let's call it their bench press. So I guess finding the things in the weight room that do motivate them, how effective is that?
I think, you know, I guess I kind of got lost in the question there. So vertical jump, yeah, it is very important for our kids. But it's not something that, like, we jump in the off season. We jump once a week. You know, we'll pull out the plyo mats, and we're always trying to beat that number. You know, just like, you know, for football and some of our other sports, we're doing flying tens once a week. So we're always trying to beat the number of the week before. So, yeah, that is a goal, is to try to increase our vertical jump. But I guess I'm thinking more of, like, how can I support their goal as a basketball player or a volleyball player by doing things in the weight room you know, maybe it's, you know, for volleyball, like volleyball is a big vertical jump, you know, sport, you know. But then also, you know, it could be like, you know, getting the feel for how to keep your shoulders back. Like, let's work on really trying to keep your shoulders back and work on your posture. And then once you get the feeling of what I'm talking about, you're going to understand why. You know, like being able to pull your shoulders back, keep your chest beating and shoulders back when movement or posture or whatever it is. I think there's got to be other ways to connect it to the sport for the other sports outside of football.
And I think you answered the question very well. I just threw that back end stuff on there. But
No,
what you said was correct. I mean, some of these kids, that weight room isn't the motivator to their goal. But 100%. As a coach, understanding that, hey, they do have certain goals that they want. And if we can help them achieve our goal, we're going to achieve the team goal in a lot of instances.
Right. That's right. Because, you know, whether it's they want to play college sports, they want to win a state championship, want to win a region championship, they want to be player of the year, whatever it is, you know, you have to find a way to get the weight room in their head that is a support to that goal, you know, especially if it's not a direct weight room goal, you know, 5 pound, 10 pound PR, you know, cut down on my 40 time, cut down on this, whatever it is. You know, you got to find ways to get their goals to kind of be supported by what you're doing in the weight room. So I think goals are important, and understanding how to help a kid map that and understand how the weight room supports what they want is very important.
Well, Coach, I appreciate all the time you've taken to sit down and answer just whatever question I could think of to throw at you. It's been really great.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. It was awesome.
Well, I hope you had a good time, and one of these days.
Yeah, man. It was great.
We'll have to do it again.
Absolutely, man.